Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries Podcast. This is your host, John Hagedorn. My days are always made better by letters of introduction, like this one. This one was dated May of 2022. Greetings. Thank you for your 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries Podcast, which inspired me to ask if you're interested in receiving a review copy of my upcoming book and or talking about it on your podcast. I retired from the CIA late last year and have completed a nonfiction book about the last mass bomber raid of World War II in Europe, of which my late uncle was a participant. The book shares the untold true story of the 5,000 Americans who flew from bases across southern Italy during the waning days of World War II to bomb the town Adolf Hitler called home. The planned repository for artistic treasures his minions had pilfered and the place he intended to retire. And it's the story of the epic journey the surviving airmen endured to return home, and how the raid and the war affected them and their families. I haven't yet pursued publication, but I will be doing so later this year. I understand you might not want or be able to commit to reviewing the book, especially prior to publication, but it would be an honor to know you might allow me to send you a review copy if the book is published and or appear on the podcast. Either way, thank you again for all you do. Kindest regards, Mike Croissant. My reply was, Mike, I'd be very interested in your story and very open to interviewing you. And now we finally got him. His book is out there. I'm looking at it now, and I have read it, and it's an absolutely excellent, excellent book, and really does tell a rare story here of the 15th Air Force, where usually we hear stories about the 8th bombing group, the one that Jimmy Stewart flew in, and others. This one flew out of Italy. These guys, many of them, believed they were going on their last mission, and we'll find out why as we go through. Mike, it's great to have you with us today.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me. Glad we finally got to do this.
I'm hoping you can share a little bit of your background that your cover letter might have missed and tell our listeners, your future readers, what inspired you to write this book.
Sure. I'm a small-town guy from Marseilles, Illinois. Very tiny town of about 5,000 people. My graduating high school class was 44. Got an education and got an education at the University of Illinois and then a couple of master's degrees. Was always interested in international affairs, so I pursued a career with the CIA. Fortunately for me, they came recruiting when I was wrapping up my second master's degree, and they gave me an offer of employment, and long story short, I served nearly 22 years, wow. mostly as an analyst, but also as a counterterrorism targeter, served all over the world, and was very glad that I did so. It was a true honor to serve. I retired.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I retired in September of 2021. And I am now working on getting this book into the hands of as many people as possible. I came across this story in 2011-12 timeframe. My uncle, Ellsworth Croissant, was a bombardier in the 459th Bomb Group. He went through the war 21 missions without a scratch, including the mission that the book is about. But unfortunately, he returned from Europe and was stationed up in South Dakota. He got the opportunity to go home on short notice, home to Illinois. He hopped on a plane and the plane crashed in Wisconsin, killing all aboard. So I obviously never met him, but his death did destroy the family, especially my father. They were very close. So I grew up knowing about my uncle, but never knowing much about who he was and what he did and how he died. So long story short, I ended up acquiring most of the letters he wrote home during the war. And I used those to piece together the missions that he was on. And I did what I could regarding each target to find out a little bit more about the city, the target, why the 15th Air Force went there. And I came across the town of Linz, Austria. This is currently the third largest city in Austria.
Linz, right?
Linz, L-I-N-Z, Linz. April 25th, 1945, the 15th Air Force was sent there to take out the extensive rail network. Aerial reconnaissance had shown that Linz rail yards were holding about 2,000 rail cars full of stuff. Now, this was just after Vienna had fallen to the Soviets. The Soviets were advancing from the east, the Americans and Brits from the west. Vienna had fallen, and the Germans had pulled back many of the anti-aircraft artillery guns that had once been defending Vienna and placed them in Linz to defend this rail junction. So it had suddenly become one of the most important communication centers remaining in Nazi Germany. And although we know now that the so-called National Redoubt in the Alps, you know, this area where the Nazis were supposedly going to fall back and carry out a guerrilla war, we know now that that was not going to happen. But at that time, they didn't know that. So the idea was to take out these rail yards and as much of the material there as possible.
Yeah, I remember a portion of your book where you said, yeah, I think there were 146 anti-aircraft guns, mostly manned by teenagers, 15 and 16-year-old young men and women. And they had 88s, which were the most effective of the anti-aircraft guns. So they had a lot of weaponry headed up into the sky.
They did indeed. And I learned doing internet research, I came across the accounts of many veterans who described it as the most horrific mission they had been on. You know, with these reinforcements of anti-aircraft guns, the Nazis were able to put up a lot of a huge barrage of anti-aircraft artillery, you know, and it would explode into metal pieces called shrapnel. And it was devastating. So that mission really captured my attention. And then when I researched Linz and I learned Hitler's connection to the city, that was it for me. I was committed, and I quickly started interviewing veterans. And over the course of probably 3 or 4 years, I interviewed 55 or so survivors of the mission. I was very fortunate. I interviewed 3 men on 2 separate bombers, several of whom were shot down. We'll talk, I'm sure, about Dale Shabilsky, who was shot down and was tortured by the Soviets. That's a whole different story.
Yeah, there was one, my notes to ask you here. Yep.
There was one bomber crew that was taken to Mauthausen, the concentration camp in Austria. They were abused. So it became very clear that this was not only a book that I could write, but it was a book that I had to write. So I started writing in 2012, and I was kind of busy. You know, I had a day job and I had 3 little kids. So it took me about 10 years to complete. And fortunately, I was given a book deal at the end of 2022. And the book will be coming out on March 26, 2024. And I can't wait for that.
I think what will impress you readers the most about this story, bombing Hitler's hometown, is its depth. It's movie script worthy, every bit of it. Every detail of what these pilots, as well as the people on the ground, went through is covered, right down to the memories of the Austrian civilians who were involved. It was a strong reminder that war is hell and the innocent often pay the price. You did a good job of handling things in the air as well as on the ground and all the people involved, even Hitler's motives to build Linz and what he felt about it. You've got it all down in the story. A fantastic story. I had no knowledge of most of this, which makes it, for you World War II buffs, there's a lot of story here that hasn't been told before, and you can tell because of all the depths of the interviews. You'll get a lot out of this story that you wouldn't get anywhere else.
It really is an untold story, and I it's easy to roll your eyes when you see on the title of a book an untold story of World War II. You know, how many more of those could there truly be? But this one, you know, it truly is an untold story, and there was so much in the National Archives, there was so much in the minds of the men, and there was enough on the internet to get a start. And once I really dove in and collected enough source material, you know, the book was actually much longer. It was 180,000 words when I first finished it, and it's now down to 107,000. So I had to leave a lot on the cutting room floor, but there truly was so much out there, and I felt that it was my duty, my job to tell the story for those men. Sadly, they have all now passed, all of them that I was in touch with.
It makes us as interviewers feel old, doesn't it?
It sure does.
When our subjects leave us, all those men deserve our praise and our thanks.
Indeed.
For their sacrifice, without
Indeed,
a doubt.
Indeed, they do.
Describe, what I'd like you to do is set our readers up. I'd like you to put them as young pilots, 18, young pilots and crewmen, ages maybe 18 to 24, with maybe the head crewman barely reaching 30. And here they are in Italy. Mostly they've been running bombing missions to support our Army's move up through Italy. But now they're being sent to places like Vienna, and they're being sent to Linz. Describe what it was like when they got the call to go to Linz on the bombing missions, what they were saying to each other, and then put us in the cockpit of one of those B-24 Liberators.
This happened on 25 April 1945. We know now that this was in the final, you know, last 2 weeks of World War II. They didn't know that. The 15th Air Force had been striking strategic targets throughout southeastern Europe since November of 1943, but in the spring of 1945, they were running out of targets. The Soviets were advancing from the east, the Americans, British, and British from the west. They were literally running out of targets. They started to strike more tactical targets in northern Italy. You know, the German army was retreating up the boot of Italy in the spring of 1945, and the men found themselves going after bridges and even individual anti-aircraft guns and troop formations. And because of that, aircraft losses dropped steeply. So I think many of the men got used to the fact that they were facing almost no opposition. So the morning of April 25th, the men were rested out of bed before dawn and called to get up and go on a mission. They went to the intelligence briefing. A curtain was removed to show a map of the target, and it was Linz. And many of the men who I spoke to could vividly remember the briefing that morning because they were so shocked. They all knew that Linz was a very difficult target. Every time they went, they faced heavy opposition. So imagine what it felt like when they were told that the number of anti-aircraft guns now defending the city had increased by about 50%. There was a lot of muttered expletives. I'm sure some men went out and vomited quietly out of, you know, anxiety. I've talked to men who did that. They were told that there could be a stiff resistance from aircraft as well, enemy aircraft, including up to 20 jet fighters. So the intelligence picture painted for them was one of, this is going to be rough, guys. This is going to be really rough. Now, the enemy aircraft threat didn't materialize because the Germans just didn't have the fuel, mostly, and in some way, enough pilots to mount that kind of a defense. But the anti-aircraft artillery that they faced was exactly what they were warned about. So the men are briefed. They make their way to breakfast. They get on their aircraft. The ground crews had been working on the aircraft throughout the night, tuning up the engines, loading the bombs on board. And they take off, I believe, around 8 a.m. The idea is to arrive at the target at noon. It's about 500 bombers and about 200 fighters, as I recall. So this isn't the biggest raid of the war, but it's a big, big raid. The men take off, and slowly, as they're circling the airfields, they get into formation, and then they start to head north. They cross over the Adriatic and over southern Germany and make a turn south towards Linz. The bomb run is about 6 minutes long. At that point, the bombardier takes over the aircraft along with the pilot and directs the aircraft through the anti-aircraft artillery barrage The barrage is 2,000 feet deep, 2,000 feet tall, and 2,000 feet long. It's literally a box of exploding shrapnel that the men have to fly through. They can't take evasive action because the bombardier is trying to put the bombs on the target. So they literally fly into what most of them described as almost a black storm cloud of exploding shrapnel. It only takes 4 minutes for the first aircraft to be shot down. 459th Bomb Group B-24 Liberator called Judith Ann. A shell passes through the nose, passing right through, right past the feet of one of the men up there, knocks out an engine, and those men go down. And that's just the start. Eventually, 15 aircraft would be shot down. The conditions at altitude, we're talking about the temperature could drop as low as 50 or 60 degrees below zero, and the men literally couldn't survive without wearing electric heated suits that would distribute heat throughout the body. They had to be on oxygen above 15,000 feet, and overall it was just a very uncomfortable experience. These aircraft were unpressurized. Wind would rush through the open windows of the waist guns and down the barrels of the machine guns. It was just extremely uncomfortable. So the men arrive over the target about noon. The first wave arrives about noon, and they are shot to pieces. The bomb strike, though, is pretty accurate right off the bat. I have a treasured copy of a photo with my uncle's name on it. He was the lead bombardier for his squadron, and it plots his bombs, and his actions were, I believe, worthy of a medal. He didn't get one, but unfortunately he didn't get one, but his bombing was very accurate. And over the course of the raid, the targets in Linz, the four rail targets, were put out of commission, which is a happy ending to a bleak story, given the toll in lives and machines that was paid.
We'll return with Mike Crozat and bombing Hitler's hometown right after these sponsor messages. And now, back to our interview. What was the significance of Linz to Hitler?
Linz was born just inside the Austrian border from Germany, and his family moved to a suburb of Linz when he was about 9 years old. And he would make the trek into Linz each day for school. He essentially spent about 9 of his first 18 years in and around the city of Linz. Linz was almost homogeneously German, and the school that he attended was a hotbed of German nationalism, and that really captured his attention. Some fairly formative events in his life happened while living in Linz. His father passed away. Later, his mother did as well. His baby brother passed as well. He began to have problems in school while in Linz. And many of the traits of the later Hitler, sort of the unwillingness to engage in systematic work, were present at this time. He would spend much of his time wandering the city, writing poetry, drawing sketches of architecture and of people. In 1905, he met a young man named August Kubizek, with whom he became friends. Hitler was known not to have many good friends, but we believe Kubizek was one of them. Kubizek went on to write a book called The Young Hitler I Knew. Kubizek relates an important episode from November 1906. The two went to an opera together. It was a Wagner piece called Rienzi. And this sent Hitler into almost a rapturous monologue, as Kubizek describes it, in which Hitler talks about his destiny to go on and lead the German people. It's pretty chilling. Whether it's absolutely true, I don't know, but it's indicative of the delusions of grandeur that Hitler had at that time. So anyway, Hitler's mother passes away in 1907, and the following year he goes off to Vienna to have a to make a failed attempt to become an art student, and the rest is sort of known to history. Hitler would always view Linz as his hometown. So in March 1938, when German troops march on Austria, Hitler first stops at his parents' grave and then makes a beeline for Linz. Linz at that time is a city of about 60,000 people. Estimates of the crowd in the square to greet Hitler are about 70 or 80,000 people. He went into the local administration building onto a balcony and addressed the crowd. There is a transcript of his remarks, and there are even some partial audio recordings. Should send a chill down your spine. He talks about his mission and how he was now fulfilling it. The crowd went nuts, and Hermann Göring, who was listening on the radio in Berlin, suggested to Hitler to take over Austria. He said, if the response is so great, why not go the whole hog? Hitler was already inclined to do so, and Austria was then annexed into Germany.
And they called it the Anschluss, right?
The Anschluss, right. So pretty fateful events surrounding Linz and Hitler. Hitler wanted to turn Linz into the cultural capital of Europe. As we now know, he sent his minions all across Europe, stealing and looting precious works of art. Those were intended to go in the Führer Museum in Linz. He also planned to retire there and be buried there. Immediately after annexing Linz, he begins to build some of these things, but the war breaks out in 1939 and doesn't go too well. The project to rebuild Linz in Hitler's image, other resources need to go to that war effort.
Now, Germany was in the throes of a severe depression, right? They were literally in food lines. It was in bad shape. So nationalism struck a pretty big chord there with those people.
So in order to pay for all of his remodeling of Linz, he industrializes the city. He builds the Göring Works, which produces steel, and then later parts for tanks. Linz is right on the Danube River, so there was production of submarines, small submarines, and other things. And with that comes a very large rail network. So between the military production and the transportation, Linz becomes a target for the Allies. So on 25 July 1944, the 15th Air Force makes its first raid on Linz. There would eventually be 22 raids total, about 800,000 tons of bombs dropped. The bombing was not really effective until the final raid, but unfortunately a lot of innocents lost their lives. About 1,680 civilians were killed, and two-thirds of the homes in Linz were damaged.
One interesting part of your book is that as a reader, you run into some unusual stories about people. And again, it's another indication of how deep you went on your research. I found a couple of stories very interesting. One was on TV writer-producer Norman Lear, who was, I think, with the 15th Bomb Group, and also George McGovern. That was his last mission. So there's some interesting stories there with some of the people that you spoke with. What do you think was the most interesting side story you ran into in your book?
Oh, boy.
There are many.
There are so many. Yes, Norman Lear and George McGovern are two of the biggest celebrities, if you will. You know, McGovern being the presidential candidate, Norman Lear being the TV producer, who, by the way, just passed a couple of weeks ago at age, I believe, 102.
Not bad.
Unfortunately, I didn't speak to either one of those men, unfortunately, but there's so many stories. I would have to say Dale Shabilsky. Dale Shabilsky was a young man from Nebraska, Omaha, Nebraska, wanted to become a pilot, but at that point in the war, the Air Force was producing so many pilots and navigators and bombardiers that they began to wash out entire classes of pilots and sending the men to gunnery school instead. So Dale Shabelsky was sent to radio school and gunnery school. He goes to the 15th Air Force, the 456 Bomb Group, and begins flying his missions in late 1944. He is very close to being done. So Dale is two missions from being done. Unfortunately, he goes away for special training near the end of the war, and the crew that he normally flies with finishes before him. So he's plugged into a crew that he doesn't usually fly with on April 25th. He doesn't know the men, and he's scared to death that, one, he's going to Linz, and two, he's going with a bunch of men he doesn't know. So they go up, they get shot to pieces. One of Dale's jobs is to make sure all the bombs fell from the bomb bay. So he looks back from his radio, and just at that moment, a shell detonates, and the shockwave knocks him off his feet. He doesn't feel it at first, but he's wounded both in the buttocks and in above the right eye. He suffers an adrenaline dump, so he doesn't know that he's wounded. He goes to brush sweat away from his face and discovers then that he's bleeding, though the tail gunner is wounded as well. The aircraft can't stay airborne for very long, so the pilot turns toward Győr, Hungary, and there they make a crash landing on a farmer's field. Hungarian partisans quickly come to the men's aid. They rush away the men who are uninjured. They take Dale aside and they send the other wounded guy in a third direction. So the crew is split up immediately. Dale is placed in a church. They bring a doctor to him and sew his wounds shut. And the partisans, the Hungarian partisans, convince Dale that he should take his uniform off and bury it, get rid of his 45, get rid of his ID. He keeps only his dog tags and his underwear. He's dressed in Hungarian civilian clothing. And they essentially walk to Budapest. And in Budapest, they find some Soviets guarding the river, an area near the river in Budapest. The men he's with say goodbye, and Dale turns himself over to the Soviets. Within a matter of minutes, they begin to beat him. Dale puts his hands up and says Amerikansky, which is what his escape kit papers told him to do. That, of course, in Russian means American. He has no ID, though. He has a dog tags, but the nearest Dale can tell is that they believe he's German. I mean, this is a young, blonde-haired, pale-skinned young man, and they accuse him of being a German spy. And over the course of the next few days, and I won't go into it here, it's all in the book, but they torture him mercilessly. It's very hard to read. After a few days, Dale finally convinces them that he's an American and that he needs to be turned over to the American consulate. They put him on a series of train rides. I think there was maybe a plane ride in there as well. He ends up in Kiev and then eventually in Odessa, Ukraine, which of course was still part of the Soviet Union then. And there he's finally put back in American custody. Dale lived to be 89 years old, I believe, and suffered obviously from post-traumatic stress his entire life because of his treatment. He was forced to sign an affidavit when he got back saying that he would never discuss the treatment that he received in Soviet hands. Fortunately, late in his life, he began to talk about it, and he wrote two memoirs, if you will. That may be overstating it a bit, but he put things down on paper, and between those and between the one interview I had with him, I pieced together his horrific experience. It's sickening, it's brutal, but it needed to be told.
When the Russians finally turned him over to the Americans, didn't they throw a huge banquet for him as if they'd treated him like a hero, create a false impression?
They threw a banquet for him. He passed out the first time out of weakness. They had him back the second day and did it again. And his attitude at that time was sort of, roll your eyes, just let's get it over with. fortunately, the nightmare ended, and he made it home.
One interesting thing about the book was that every chapter is a quote from one of the men in that chapter. Well done. I thought that was very appropriate and works very, very nicely. It shows also shows you had a big bank of interviews to work with. So that's a lot of hard work on your part. It doesn't just come your way.
I was so fortunate. You know, I reached out to so many men, and you probably noticed that many of the men who are in the book have, like myself, have sort of funny last names. And the humorous reason for that is, you know, 60, 70, 80 years after these events, it's nearly impossible to find like a Bill Smith who was on the mission. But I was able to find, you know, Achilles Kozakis, Hal Millett, Dale Shabilsky, because of the names. And I could, you know, with the help of the internet, I could sort of narrow it down. So you'll find a lot of names in there that may be a little hard to pronounce. And that's the reason, is just because it was, those guys were the easiest ones to find so many years later.
I came across another quote that wasn't in your book as I was doing some of the research for this interview, and found one where Jimmy Stewart his plane had taken pretty bad flak. This was over Germany. And it had taken enough flak that the plane cracked in half when he finally landed it. And he said to the guy who approached him, he said, "Sergeant, somebody sure could get hurt in one of these damn things."
You know, the memories of the mission were so vivid. You know, many of the men I talked to were well on their way to finishing their tours. At that time, the tour length was 35 missions. And many of them couldn't remember in any detail any missions except that one. It was so horrific. And one little story I'll tell is from Ken Becker, who was a navigator on a B-17 with the 99th Bomb Group. In the B-17, the navigator faced toward the rear of the aircraft. And during the bomb run, Ken would sit back to back with the man who pulled the lever or pushed the lever to drop the bombs. The idea being that if flak struck the front of the plane, it would hit that man first before it hit Ken. I talked to both of them, and they both made fun of each other for that. But anyway, Ken went through the whole war, 17 missions for him, without looking out the nose of the plane over the target. And he told me, "That day, I just decided I had to get up and look out the window." And he stood up and he looked out, and then he saw white smoke, brown smoke, and black smoke. And I kid you not, I went to the National Archives, the 99th Bomb Group. I found a photo of the target, and how many types of smoke did you think I found in that photo? Three types of smoke.
Wow.
It was absolutely unbelievable. Such, you know, these memories were burned into these men's minds, you know.
Wow. Fantastic, fantastic story. Is there anything else you would like to add?
I want to thank you for having me. The book will be coming out in March. I hope everyone remotely interested in this topic reads it. It's as much a combat story as it is a story about survival and recovering from post-traumatic stress. You can read more about it and about me on my website, mikecroissant.com, or bombinghitlershometown.com.
And readers, I'd like you to know again, it's Bombing Hitler's Hometown by Mike Croissant, the untold story of the last mass bomber raid of World War II in Europe. And up at the top right, General David Petraeus says, "Extraordinary page turning." What a wonderful testimonial that is. Good one. And there are many testimonials on the back of the book. It's a fantastic book, folks. It's good reading. We only covered a little bit of what's in here for you, and it's a page turner. Every single page is just well researched, and a lot of it is interview based. Just a wonderfully done piece of work. Mike, thank you so much for this book.
Thank
Appreciate
you,
John. It.
Thank you. God bless.